Sometimes, for our sakes, God is willing to settle for second best. Sometimes God allows us to have something that God wishes we could do without, but knows that we can't. The best biblical illustration of this is the Israelite monarchy. The people said, "We want a king." And God said, "Don't be stupid. You don't need a king. Kings always turn out to be megalomaniacs who overtax everyone and send your sons off to war. You would be better off without one." But the people said, "We still want a king." And in the end, God concedes that while it would be better if the people didn't need a king, they can't seem to cope without one. So God settles for second best and gives them a king. And most of the things God said about kings turned out to be perfectly true. So God settles for second best there. And there are lots and lots of passages in the rest of the Bible that make it sound as though God is so much behind the king that the monarchy must have been God's idea. Having settled for second best, God gets right behind the monarchy and makes the most of it. But the fact remains that in God's ideal world, there would be no kings. Sometimes when God settles for and gets behind a second best option, we are in danger of completely forgetting that God wasn't too keen on the idea in the first place. And we can even get to the stage where we think that it is the most precious thing in the world to God. Tonight's reading from the Revelation to John, like most of the Revelation to John, contains some rather startling images. And in this one, John has a vision of the New Jerusalem coming down out of heaven from God. This is the centerpiece of God's new creation, and the description of it is breathtaking. The city is lit up with the glory of God, and people come streaming through its gates from all over the world to worship God. And at this point, I'm going to pause and apologise to the kids over there, because I just realised, as I said, City of God, that the title of the kids' pack sheet was City of God, and I forgot to print it out, so it's not over there. So apologies. So people come streaming through the gates of this city that isn't in the kids' packs from all over the world to worship God. And the water of life runs through the middle of the city from the throne of God. And the tree of life grows there, bearing fruits and leaves that bring healing and life to all the nations of the earth. What we are seeing in this vision is the reconciliation of heaven and earth. It's even depicted as the marriage of heaven and earth. Once the new holy city with God's throne at its centre is established on the earth, as the vision depicts, there will be no more distinction between heaven and earth. The two will have become one. Earth is heaven and heaven is earth. And when that happens, nothing that is second best will remain. Everything will be reconciled and made best. Once we taste the fullness of God's best for us, we will no longer be twisting God's arm to have anything less, like monarchies and things like that. All those things that fall short of God's ideal, like second-rate political systems, will be abolished and replaced with God's perfect alternative. Now, among all the startling images in this vision is a little reference to a feature of the New Jerusalem that highlights another second best that we've settled for. And it's one that comes as a shock to many of us. When the reign of God comes to fruition and the new holy city is established at God's command, it will be a city without even a single church building. Church buildings of all kinds, from the humblest chapel to the most grandiose cathedral, from the whitewashed preaching barn to the most ornate basilica, all of them will be abolished, and apparently God will be glad to be rid of them. Now, John doesn't actually go into a great deal of detail on this. He simply says, while describing the city he saw in his vision, I saw no temple in the city, for its temple is the Lord God, the Almighty, and the Lamb. Why is there no special place of worship set aside in the city built by God? Because it doesn't need one. Because ideally, it would never have needed one. We would never have needed one. But God let us have them anyway because we weren't coping too well without them. Now, this obviously raises a few pointed questions for us. After all, we are gathered here in a church building. It's not the most ornate or awe-inspiring in the history of church architecture, but we do our best to make it look nice and to give it a sense of atmosphere that stimulates us to pray and worship. And some of us have grown rather attached to it. I know sometimes when I go into the prayer chapel, I have occasionally thought as I reached for the door handle, what if somebody's been in and vandalised it? I'd actually be distraught. It's a special place to me. It often feels like a place where the distance between earth and heaven is a lot less. So why is God not so keen on such places? Why are they no more than second best? Why is God planning to abolish them? And what does that mean for the way we worship in this place? The beginning of the answer to those questions is given in the brief reference in the vision. A temple would be superfluous. When everything is brought to fulfillment and heaven and earth are one, there would be no meaningful function that a temple or church could serve. For us, the church building functions as a kind of icon or sacrament. When we look at an icon, we don't claim to be looking at God, but that we are looking at something that helps us to think of God. It's a bit like a window, in that what we are really trying to do is look through it and beyond it to catch a sight of what the icon can really only ever hint at. When we gather around the table for the sacrament of bread and wine, it's not because we think that the bread and wine is all there is of Christ or that Christ is nowhere else, but because focusing our attention on the presence of Christ here helps us to begin to taste more of the presence of Christ everywhere. So the church building can be a bit like such an icon or a sacrament. We don't claim that God is more present here than anywhere else, or that heaven is actually closer to earth here than elsewhere. But the church is a place where we are used to focusing our attention on the presence of God. It is a place where we are used to praying as though we were walking into this space and through it right into the banqueting room of heaven itself. So with time and practice, it's become easier for us to perceive God's presence here than it is in our workplace or in our lounge room or out on the street or wherever. It's a place that we have made sacred in order to help us to sense the sacred in every place by starting somewhere. But in the new holy city, with the throne of God in the centre and the whole city lit up with the glory of God, what would be the point? When every place has become clearly a place of the presence of God and is filled with the presence of God and reflects the glory of God, how could you set aside a place to be more of that? We would have no need of special places to help us open ourselves to God or to train us to perceive the presence of God elsewhere. So a special place set aside for the worship of God would be kind of a bit like setting aside a place for breathing or something like that. It's just unnecessary. Although if we keep polluting things, that might become necessary. But I don't think that that's all that there is to the Revelation note that there will be no temple, no church building in the new holy city. I think there is also a more pointed criticism of what church buildings sometimes do to our understanding of God and to our practice of religion. And I think it is something that we need to be reminded of here too. You see, this is by no means the first time in the Bible that the value of the temple has been questioned. This is, you might have noted, the second last chapter of the Bible. It's not the first time the question of the value of temples has been raised. There was a debate when King David first proposed building a temple. You may remember the words of God through the prophet, "Does God live in houses made by human hands?" Then the debate raged again each time the temple was destroyed by an invading army and the people had to decide whether or not to rebuild it. And Jesus saw the temple as something that needed cleansing, and he predicted its destruction without much apparent dismay. He even joked about doing it himself. The first Christian martyr, Stephen, was stoned to death after a speech that included quoting the prophets again to question the value of the temple. We could spend hours going through the examples. John's image in the Revelation seems to be the last in a long line of biblical passages suggesting that sacred buildings had always had the potential to corrupt true faith. Again, we could spend hours unpacking the reasons why, but we won't. I just want to touch on a couple of them. The first was apparent in ancient Israel particularly. An ideology grew up around the temple that said that because it was the house of God, then it stood to reason that God would not let his house be destroyed. And therefore, the city where the temple stood was immune to disaster. The people's image of God became so localized that they thought that God cared about them and about this place more than any other place or any other people, and that therefore they were under God's special protection, whether or not they lived in accordance with what God was calling them to. The presence of God and the activity of God came to be understood as being located in and almost confined to this fixed object, this place, this building. And so the temple became like a lucky charm to them, an idol, a thing that they put their trust in to protect them and ensure their well-being. We will be safe because we live next door to the temple, kind of thing. And so, like every idol, it became an obstacle to God rather than a mediator of God. Alongside that, there was all the activity and hierarchy that came to be associated with the temple and has continued to be associated with churches or with any other big sacred building. It's easy for those whose work and livelihoods revolve around the temple to begin to think and teach that it is the maintenance of the temple and its staff and its ritual actions that is the centre of true religion. If I could run a successful marketing campaign selling the idea that God is really in this place here more than any other place, and that all God really wants from people is that they come here, participate in what we do here, and contribute to the financial resources of this place and its work, I would probably pull a much healthier paycheck than I am at the moment. But I would be a liar. I would be failing to tell you that God is actually much, much more interested in whether you love your neighbour than how much you put in the offering. I would be failing to tell you that God is much more concerned with whether you are merciful to those who you meet during the week than how well you sang "Lord Have Mercy" tonight. I would be failing to tell you that God is much more concerned to see people doing justice and compassion than to see them doing good liturgy. As long as the church buildings and the liturgies and activities that take place in them are shaping a people who will worship God by the way they prayerfully live out their lives in love, mercy, justice, and peace, then those buildings and their activities have a valuable place in our lives. But the history of such places shows how easily they can be corrupted so that we substitute the adoration of the place and its systems for the honouring of God in godly living. When God let us have a temple and later church buildings, it was always a bit of a risky move on God's part, a second best option, taken as a concession to our need for things to help us perceive the presence of God and taste the fruits of heaven. God allows us to make use of such things and even honours our use of them, because God knows that most of us are still a long way short of being able to do without them. I certainly am. But if we are not reminded from time to time of the inherent dangers in our use of church buildings, then we are running a grave risk of repeating the mistakes that Jesus and the prophets spoke against. Churches and their ceremonies can contribute to our ability to be the people of God, who live out the love, mercy, justice, and hospitality of God in the world. But in the Revelation, John tells us that the day is coming when they would be utterly superfluous. God will have given us a new holy city with no church buildings at all, because we will all know every place to be alive with the presence of God, and we will worship God with our every action and our every breath. Come, Lord Jesus, come.